Hi, my name is Amanda Hale, and this is podcast number 6 in the Mad Hatter series. The Subversive Child, Her Talent of Invisibility. I want to talk about voice, specifically the question of voice in my most recent novel, Mad Hatter, which is a fictionalized account of my own family's experience as a result of our father's internment during World War II in England. While in progress with the writing of Mad Hatter, and a few years before publication, I attended a writers' union event at Harbourfront in Toronto. It was called First Page Challenge. Participants submitted the first page of a book in progress, duly displayed on a large screen for the audience to see, while a panel of three, a writer, an agent, and a publisher, gave comments on the page. One person on my panel, the writer Nino Ricci, had remarkable insight into my book from that first page, which is a prologue, one of those italicized, poetic, enigmatic pieces that readers tend to forget about until the end of the book. Then they go back to the beginning and say, "Ah, that's what it meant." A few of my readers have been confused about the question of voice in Mad Hatter, which doesn't surprise me because it was something I struggled with during the writing. I'll read you the prologue. The head of our family was missing. Drowned, they said. And I, a slow but persistent swimmer and a believer in magic, spent my childhood diving for him, over and over, coming up gasping for air, not knowing whom I sought. I lived in his body before I became myself. I was with him when he was arrested. I was with him in the holding stall and in his cell, adrift in that lonely sea of which I still dream, a fathomless expanse without a shore. This thrills and terrifies me in equal parts, a creature suspended who must imagine her world. I was with him at Ascot Camp and at Latchmere, and when they let him out on overnight leave, I made my escape. A swimmer from the outset, I entered another body and took root there, throbbing with the blood I fed on, blood that made me who I am, until I was expelled into this world through which I have moved for 57 years, pulsing to the rhythm of my mother's heart. Yet a part of me remains with him in that prison cell, observing and recording. He lives in me, as I lived in him, more insistent, perhaps, than for the rest of my siblings, though each one of us is, in our own way, haunted by the enigma of that man. Imagine a day, sun rising on a palimpsest of shadows so dense and peopled that not even its noontime brilliance can dispel the throng. We remain, my father and I, entwined in shadow. His presence lingers, like the perfume of a woman long after she has left the room. This perfume is memory, my memory of unconditional love for a man I scarcely knew. This prologue is in fact the voice of Katie, who will become the narrator in part 2 of the novel. In the prologue, she is as yet unconceived. Only later, moving into the body of the novel, excuse the pun, is she speaking in utero, in short fragments of italicized poetic commentary, as her awareness of her parents and of the world around them grows. One very perceptive reader recognized that this one-page prologue is in fact a condensation of the entire 444-page story. It was a delightful moment when she told me this, because it was something I had not fully realized myself. That particular reader is a swimmer, at the level of channel swimming between England and France. No doubt her own experience helped her to recognize my metaphorical allusions to underwater swimming, both in the prologue and in the following sequence. This is chapter 6 of part 3, narrated by Katie in the spring of 1948. She is 6 years old in this chapter, which is titled Underwater. When my siblings were away at boarding school, Mum took me for swimming lessons on Saturday afternoons. She would hover at the poolside, blocking the sun that filtered through the high windows of the indoor pool at the Buxton Hotel. It was almost spring, and she was as determined that I should learn to swim before the summer holidays as she had been that I should read. Swimming seemed to me a magical thing, quite unlike the struggle of learning to read. The instructor wore a white cap and a navy blue bathing suit with white piping, and she had a whistle dangling from her neck for emergencies. She supported me with her hand under my stomach as I floated precariously, trying not to get water up my nose. "Kick your feet, Katie. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Relax your knees and ankles." Her voice echoed past the quivering diving board and into the high green ceiling. I kicked and wobbled, filling up with fear as I watched Mum's legs out of the corner of my eye, her nylons and high-heeled shoes, the slit in the back of her tweed skirt. Even when she was out of sight, I could hear the click of her heels as she followed us on our slow progress through the water. As we approached the deep end, the instructor let go of me, and I panicked, flailing with my arms, inhaling water as I went down. It was silent under the water, and everything trembled. My hands and arms were liquid with wavy contours, and I felt like a mermaid with my eyes open and my hair streaming out from my fishy head. What could I discover here in my magic realm as the silence of the water enclosed me? Babies are natural swimmers. How had I become a non-swimmer? Was I going to drown? I felt quite calm until strong hands lifted me to the surface of the pool and floated me to the shallow end, gulping and spluttering, with water streaming from my nose. "There's nothing to be afraid of, Katie. You can do it," the rubber-capped instructor said. "But perhaps that's enough for now. Same time next week." "No, no, I want to go under again, to sink into the silent, watery world, to swim with my slow limbs in the green quietness." That was it. I was an underwater swimmer, searching for something there, something that did not exist outside the water. It was the air and the light of the world above that confounded me, and where I began to drown. A writer has no control over how the reader receives and interprets her work. You have to decide what you, the writer, want to say, and then who exactly you hope to engage. You can't cater to every taste or capability. If you do, you end up with a bland porridge that has taken no risks, made no stand, a crowd pleaser that in the end pleases no one. I took a risk in starting my book in the voice of a child not yet conceived, and by continuing with a fragmented in utero voice, and again in letting Katie be a full narrator at the age of 15 months. However, I have been guided and influenced by many books and films that have used the child's voice at varying stages of development. This kind of voice is riveting for me in that it allows the poetics of the womb. Remember your origin, floating and expanding gradually and peacefully in what I have called that lonely sea of which I still dream, a fathomless expanse without a shore. This is the place of gestation where we begin, suspended in liquid, gathering force for an unknown future, a place of complete passivity. And yet what power there is in that gathering of sensory information that will serve the fetus as it emerges on a shockingly perilous journey into a dangerous world where it must bond and engage, learn to survive under drastic circumstances never before encountered. Katie's in-the-world voice can never be as strong as her preconception and in-utero voices. Even though she is afraid of the water, afraid of learning to swim, she recognizes, and here I quote, "Babies are natural swimmers," and she wonders, "How had I become a non-swimmer?" She wants to go underwater again, to swim with slow limbs in the green quietness. Then her realization, quote, "I was an underwater swimmer, searching for something there, something that did not exist outside the water. It was the air and the light of the world above that confounded me, and where I began to drown." I was influenced in particular by Luna Papa, a Russian film released in 1999, directed by Bukhtiar Khudojnazarov. This magical realist tragicomedy takes place in a small village in Tajikistan, not far from Samarkand, where 17-year-old Mamlakat dreams of becoming an actress. One moonlit night, she is seduced by a mysterious stranger who claims to be a friend of Tom Cruise. He disappears, leaving Mamlakat pregnant. For her father, Safar, and brother, Nasreddin, restoring the family honor is a question of pride, and they set out together to find the culprit. The story is told by the unborn child, who has chosen Mamlakat as his mother even before he is conceived. When I began in the early 2000s to write Mad Hatter in an attempt to discover my father, I was inspired by Luna Papa and by my own mysterious emotional memories. My novel begins, as does Luna Papa, with the voice of a child. That voice recurs intermittently, identified by italics, until the moment on page 183, at the end of part one, when the Irish housekeeper, Mary Byrne, ceases to be narrator of the story, and Katie, now aged 15 months, takes over. Katie speaks from adulthood about her childhood experiences and observations, which are not far removed from Mary Byrne's own outsider observations. After all, Katie is recently arrived, in January 1942, in a world at war. The family is her world at that time, and she has nothing to compare it to, so she accepts everything as normal, the way that children do. Mary, at 23, though she has strong opinions, has an innate intelligence without the bias of an educational system. She has basic family values and a huge and loving heart. She has the sight, something that guides her through the minefield of her life as a housekeeper in the Brooke household. The marriage between the clarity of childhood perception and the wisdom of adult recall is a juggling act. As children, we can see that the emperor is naked, and only gradually do we lose that clarity as we weave our way into the social construct, taking our place amidst the irrational agreements that guarantee our functionality within the collective. Mary Byrne is a purely fictional character. She was one of those gifts to a writer, a person who arrives in full costume, never lost for words. She was the easiest character to write. I accepted her mysterious but very down-to-earth presence and never questioned who she might be. I thought for a while that she might be a symbol of all those women to whom I dedicate Mad Hatter. Nannies, housekeepers, teachers, cleaners, and cooks. Only recently has it dawned on me that Mary Byrne is perhaps a young adult version of the child I was, though my own adulthood has taken a different turn. Interesting to have written a character who is my own and everyone else's favorite without realizing who exactly she was. Only now, liberated by the reception of this story by my readers, can I own up to her and to her wise, witty, but silenced perceptions. There is a point in the novel when Katie recognizes something about her own identity and a possible mission in life. In this scene, Katie's mother, Cynthia, has received a letter informing her of her truant husband's whereabouts. Upset by the news, she confides in Vera, a woman who has taken wartime refuge in the Brooke household with her young daughter, Sandra. I'll read to you now from a chapter called The Talent of Invisibility. The letter came in the third week of January, just before my fifth birthday. I hoped Daddy would be home for my big day and that he would bring me a horse. Charlotte, Jimmy, and Birdie had gone back to boarding school, and I was left at home with only Sandra to play with. We were in the grip of a deep freeze with huge snowdrifts. We couldn't see the farm behind our house. The field was completely white with big puffs of snow still falling. Vera had done a half-hearted shoveling of our driveway, so the postman managed to make his way to the front door, and that's how we found out. "Nothing but bills," Mum said, riffling through the envelopes. She opened the hall desk where my father kept his papers neatly stacked in wooden compartments behind the leather-covered writing surface, and she tossed the bills in for him to deal with when he came home. He was gone again, but was rarely away more than 2 weeks at a time. "Oh, here's something," she said, holding up a plain white envelope with a handwritten address in writing she didn't recognize. She picked up a paper knife and slit the envelope open. I'll never forget her face as she read that letter. A look of fury came over her, and she began to tremble. Then tears spilled down her cheeks. It is a terrifying thing to see your mother cry, for what can be done when the person who governs your life loses control? What had happened? What would we do? I reached up to pat her hand, but she pushed me away and ran into the sitting room. I stood at the door and watched as she lit a cigarette and sat there trembling and breathing smoke like a dragon. She read the letter again, more slowly and carefully this time. Then she scrunched it up and threw it into the fire, where it flared and turned into a brown curl that collapsed into ashes. I could hear Vera's voice floating down the corridor as she sang along with Doris Day. With a song in my heart, I behold your adorable face. Mum must have heard it too, because she jumped up suddenly and marched towards the kitchen. I flattened myself against the wall, feeling a rush of air as she passed. Then I followed her down the corridor and listened. Now look what he's done! He's gone to bloody South Africa! What? Vera looked up from her ironing. Can you believe it? This is the last straw! What are you talking about? My husband was too much of a coward to tell me himself. He got Baker to write a letter and post it just before they left. Look, here's the envelope. It's postmarked January 23rd. That was only yesterday. Fast delivery, Vera said. Mum was silent, her face white and pinched. Sandra was playing under the kitchen table, and she saw me pressed against the wall, so I put my finger to my lips, warning her to keep quiet. But why would he go to South Africa? It's a long way in the middle of winter. To preach his damned gospel, what else? Is he coming back? I don't know. I'm always the last one to know his whereabouts. She began to cry again, her face hidden in her hands, her shoulders shaking, and I began to cry too. I didn't know if I was crying for my mother's unhappiness or for fear of not seeing my father again. I just knew I had to be quiet about it. Never mind, Vera said, setting the iron down and placing her hand on Cynthia's shoulder, patting it nervously. We'll manage, the two of us, till he comes home. Would you like a nip of gin? I want a cup of tea. They passed by without seeing me and went into the scullery. That's what he was doing all this time away in London, getting his travel papers in order, his passport and vaccinations. How could he have been so cruel as to keep it from me? Well, you're not the only one who's been let down, Vera said. Look at me with my little bastard. She meant Sandra. I glanced over to see if she'd heard, but she was in her own world, muttering to herself under the table. And that American bastard disappeared off the face of the earth. It's quite different, Cynthia said dismissively. Christopher is my husband of 13 years. He's going to miss our anniversary and Katie's birthday. It's so unfair. He never thinks of us, only of that bloody Baker and their ridiculous... Well, you chose him, Vera said, but quickly regretted her words and backtracked. I'm sorry, Cynthia. I didn't mean... It was impertinent of me. She didn't wait for the tea, but swept past me once again. That's when I realized that I was invisible. I knew in that moment that it was my talent and my power to make myself so, and I thanked the fairies for it and resolved to use it well. Adding silence to my invisibility, I would go forth to conquer the world, armed with my advantages, spying and harbouring my knowledge for a better day. The next few days were very gloomy. Granny Brooke telephoned to say that Grandpa was poorly and wouldn't get out of bed. I heard Mum crying again as she talked to Granny in a low voice. Off in Africa. Emptied our bank account. What can I do? I heard her blowing her nose and thanking Granny over and over. After she put the receiver down, she powdered her nose and applied fresh lipstick. Then she put on her fur coat and snow boots, took me by the hand and led me into the kitchen. Look after Katie, she said to Vera. I'm driving over to Dinglewood. I won't be long. I crept under the table with Sandra, and we made a fortress out of building blocks to protect ourselves from the grown-ups. This is the moment in which Katie becomes the subversive child, hidden, secretive, watching and plotting, harbouring her knowledge for a better day, as she tells us. She is later influenced by war films that portray a romantic myth around the life of a spy, and by her family's constant reminder that children should be seen and not heard. Is this myself, the writer? Not really. This is the writer's art of transformation. They say that every character we write is a facet of ourselves. I thought that Mary Byrne was a character who came to me ready-made, but I was in fact channeling a facet of my own character, one that never developed, giving myself a voice that had been silenced in early childhood. There are scenes in Mad Hatter where neither Mary Byrne nor Katie are present, as well as thoughts expressed and conversations spoken that they could not have intuited or heard. For these sequences, I used the omniscient voice, a third-person point of view that allows the narrator access to thoughts and feelings of all the characters. Of course, there are many plot-driven readers who do not concern themselves with the question of voice and simply keep on reading to see what will happen next. But for the writer, it is vital to reach a point of clarity regarding voice, however complex that might be. Thank you for listening. If this podcast has whetted your appetite to know what exactly happens in Mad Hatter, the book is available in paperback and as an e-book from Guernica Editions. If you prefer to listen to the audiobook version, go to audible.ca, where you can hear a 5-minute sample reading before downloading Mad Hatter. For information on all my books, see my website, amandahale.com. My work is also available through Canadian libraries or by ordering from your local indie bookstore, and as a last resort at the sometimes unavoidable Amazon. However, I do strongly recommend buying from independent publishers and bookstores. Thank you.